Yep, we're ready to go. So February 14th, happy Valentine's Day, everybody. I'm sorry that you're all in trouble.
I'm sorry.
I appreciate the company.
Hey,
we'll be done. We're going to be done. First item on the agenda is a roll call vote.
Kit?
Yep.
And Don?
Here.
Malcolm?
Yep.
Robin?
Yep.
And Jim?
Yep.
Harold is here.
Yep.
Gordy?
Here.
Jack?
Here.
Ron?
Here.
And Grace is not here. And James is here and Nora is here.
Okay. First item that we have on the agenda is the consent calendar. So we have two meetings that we didn't haven't approved the minutes yet, November 8th and December 13th. So are there any changes on either one of these sets of minutes that anybody had? If not, I would accept a motion to approve the minutes as been presented. Moved by Gordon.
Second.
Second by Ron. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Before we move into the next agenda, everybody's, we have some handouts that you have received. One is a new update as far as the who's on the committee. There's one new person that will be probably appointed to Wednesday. Her name is Margaret Goodwin. And I think she'll probably be here tonight, but she will be taking the place of Eugene Dunaway. And as I understand it in talking to Terry, the one for the Murphy area is somebody by the name of... Hi, Peggy. This is Peggy Goodwin. And that person will be probably William Ertle, but I haven't heard any more on that at this point in time. And he would be coming through the Williamstown Council as a representative. So haven't heard any more on that. I know that he made the application, and so far is the only name that's been brought forward. There is a letter from Bob Hart dated today. He couldn't be at the meeting. For some comments. There's also a map that I believe was furnished by Malcolm.
Yeah.
On the rural, okay, Josephine County Rural Fire District that shows the map for the districts and then that uncovered area or the non-district areas. Yeah,
proposed fire district.
And then also is a document that has the recommendation, amended recommendations on the wildfire ARCA 76. So those will be things for you to look at, as well as the calendar for the rest of the year, and I'd ask people to take a look at that. If is there going to be any problem? Is it okay to maintain this date that we have as a consistent meeting date? It seems to have been working, except for today and the Oregon football game. But if that's okay, then we'll just accept this as our standard meeting time, which has been set out as the second Monday of every month. Okay, and the other next item is planning director update. I'm sure we're all on the edge of the chair to understand what's going on in the continuing saga of the planning director for Josephine County. So at this time, James,
yeah,
if you give us
I have a statement that I was supposed to read to you all, just kind of from the HR department. So.
Could you read it real slow for us?
I will do that.
Okay.
Yeah.
You could change it between that and the statement.
Yeah, If you have not already heard, Andrew Sheridan resigned as the planning director on February 4th, 2011. All I can say is the county was conducting an investigation in which he voluntarily resigned. In lieu of this, the Board of Commissioners appointed Roger Virata, our senior planner, as in charge of the daily operations of our department. The board has offered the planning director position to another candidate who fared well in our previous interviews. His name is David Wechner. Mr. Wechner has verbally accepted this position, is expected to start on March 1st of 2011. Then it says that any questions regarding the matter can be directed to the Human Resources Department. So that's all I have to report. That's all I got.
How do you spell the name of the...
David Wechner, W-E-C-H-N-E-R.
Okay. What's that?
how it spells now.
I was going to say, did you promise to keep this?
Yeah. We'll see.
We'll update you.
Yeah.
What's your alias, James?
I'll let you know later.
I saw you changing in the home booth.
Yeah.
What I would like to do is, in view, we've got Margaret Peggy Goodwin here is going to be our new member as of probably Wednesday when she's officially appointed. But could you just go around and introduce each other, introduce yourselves so Peggy gets an idea of who we are?
Great. Pick those up when you go.
So let's... Peggy knows me.
There's
So why don't we start here, Ron, just going around.
I'm Ron Wright. I'm the planning chair for the county.
You know me, I'm Don.
Hi, Don. Walkers.
We haven't met, I'm Jim Brick.
Nice to meet you, Jim.
Greggy.
Yes. You're Peggy, did you say?
Welcome aboard.
I'm Peggy.
Yeah. Welcome aboard. The other thing I'd like to do is if we just go ahead and introduce the guests that are here tonight, and if you start over in the corner, just come on around.
Ford Ockenden.
Okay.
Harry Ashley.
Harry Scott.
Caleb McAllister.
Laura Woodcock.
Okay, great. Thank you. So our next item is Deer Winter Range. Grace is...
We were here at a quarter to six, and no one was outside.
I've many times told him the time, but I haven't been made to laugh. You know, I'm assuming. You know.
Yeah.
Maybe you got lost on the winter range.
But I guess what we can do is just we'll move on the rest of the agenda, and then when he gets here, we'll jump back to.
Yeah.
You three haven't said who that you guys were.
We're anonymous. Oh, okay.
And I'm James Black with the planning department.
And I'm Ann with the planning department.
And I'm Harold. We know each other. Thanks for the reminder. Anyway, let's move to the road standards and continuation subcommittee report. And I guess what I, from my perspective, and I've been making comment, is that I would like us to finalize the road standards issue and be ready to take some kind of an action at our March meeting. So the things that we'll be looking at would be the recommendations that were presented by the subcommittee. I'd ask that you review the discussions that we've had, and I think the subcommittee will be preparing the document for our consideration at the next March, what is the date? 14th meeting. And the hope would be is that you'll have some documents in your hands before that meeting so you have a chance to take a look at those and have an opportunity to discuss, but my intent would be for us to take an action to pass on a recommendation to the Board of County Commissioners at that meeting, and then move on to the rest of our items, which we have as the Deer Winter Range and the Article 76, and then some of the other issues, the property line type of discussions, and any other types of issues that are going to be coming up. So, is there any problem? Does anybody feel there may be a problem with that agenda? Yeah.
Wait in the minutes. Of last December's meeting, it said you suggested not only the road standards, but also Article 76 be finished by March.
Hopefully, but because we lost that January date, I'm going to probably move this Article 76 to the April. Yeah, so that because you have all your information, you folks have got the information.
Yeah,
you're
everybody's
reading
really helpful.
Yeah.
Half the people, plus one, I think, have already heard.
Yeah. So that will be sort of the schedule and the process that we have going right now. So are there some other comments or things you'd like to bring up on the road standards that people got? Yeah?
I'm wondering at this point,
quite literally all of the discussion, and she's been on the table for a couple of months. Why are we going to put it to an up or down vote right now?
One, it wasn't scheduled for that purpose. It was discussion. That's the only thing.
Well, then I do have a question.
Okay.
Besides the recommendation of the commissioners that they get involved with HB 2229, what other recommendations have we sent in the year we've been doing this?
One. That was it. Okay. Any discussion on the road issues? Any other comments? If not, we'll plan on that for being a final decision on March 13th. Probably not. And everybody should have a letter that Bob Hart, I think, submitted. Did everybody get it in the email, or did it got approved as far as his comments are concerned? The only other area was the property line adjustment, and there was some discussion between, a written discussion between Bob and, I think, Malcolm, you had some comments.
Yeah, mine really wasn't germane to what he's talking about. I was just wondering how we were going to do surveys on smaller lots, and that wasn't what he's talking about. Right.
Does anybody have any comments in regards to the property line?
Before I probably what is the last word on the road standards that we have?
The last document that we had was the recommendations. It was a proposed changes to the development code. But, and I have the date on it that I have is 7-12-10. 7-12-10 is the date that I had written on that, this document that I had received.
Yeah.
Right. And then along with that were some memos that from the county engineer, from Mike Snyder, and Rob Brandis. And then there was a follow-up, I believe, from... did Bob Hart provide another comment about on some of that?
Yes, he did.
Okay. But the main document that would be addressing would be the recommendations that came from that original seven-page document, and then whatever the document is. And what I'd ask the subcommittee to do is prepare a document to identify the specific areas within the local ordinance that we'll be making the changes to, and that they're working on that document right now. And that's the document that we hope we get be able to get to you folks before the March 14th meeting. So.
Well, you're the planning department, isn't it?
Oh, do you?
Sorry, I need to figure that up. I just need about maybe, is it the screen here?
Yeah. So you need to be over there?
Yeah, probably about in the middle there would be good, or on the other side might work too. I'm sorry about my tardiness, I misunderstood.
Okay. So why don't you take about a 5-minute break and let him get set up, and then we'll go from there.
See where it is. What I have to do is have no plan. And then what I do tomorrow is go to the
Well, I think we'll be thinking each one of the changes, but I think what the documents are going to have, I haven't seen anything, but will be to address a specific section of the local ordinance that would be making the changes. It's what the committee's going to want. I'll lay it out as a whole document, and then they can go from there.
Until I got there,
These are copies of the deer winter range. Does everyone have these? These are what were circulated at the time when we were beginning to set everything up. We had yours in there, and then this is another. I have made copies for everybody, but I don't know if everybody still has them.
Good night, Sam. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I did.
Mm-hmm. And you're coming as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, but this I don't have.
Well, this is what he said.
Oh, okay. Then he's going to give us some more.
Okay, so if everyone needs a copy, do you need a copy? I think he did. But maybe we should ask if they've done it.
Yeah.
If you want one of each one.
And then I think Steve got, this is just for the building.
Mm-hmm.
So, oh, yeah.
So, pass them around or whatever, just to have copies. Okay?
Okay, she just asked for me, so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure we'll have some questions for you. So.
Okay.
Oh,
that's scary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
two of them, right? They were a big buck, and he probably had an 8-point rack on him. And he landed, and he bounced, and he slid. He didn't come down feet first. He put his feet sideways, and he slid right across the top. Right?
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
If he'd have landed on it, it would have been ugly.
They do that sometimes. They'll do it right up. I don't sit down in front of
them. I hit one.
I need to pretend that I never came home and saw that.
I'm the assistant district wildlife biologist.
Yep. Assistant district wildlife biologist.
This is Steve Bula, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife assistant wildlife biologist.
Very good, yes.
Almost.
Almost. District wildlife biologist. And the district is the Rogue Watershed District. So our district takes Jack and Josephine and Curry County. I mean, it's a little bit more than that, but generally that's what it is because of it's the watershed of the Rogue River. We also have a satellite office in Gold Beach, though, and they pretty much handle the west side of Curry County. So thanks for the introduction and especially for the invitation. I appreciate everybody wanting to hear about some of the research we've been conducting. I do apologize just one more time for being late. I don't mean to inconvenience you folks. I know your time is valuable as well. But I'll just jump right into the talk here. Okay, so what we're going to talk about really today is vertical migration by black-tailed deer in Josephine County. And so there's all kinds of migration. Usually what we think of in the terms of migration, of course, are birds going south through the winter, coming back for the summer. But what we have here in Josephine County and in Jackson County and a lot of areas throughout the western United States is these deer move up and down to basically get out of the snow that comes in the high country. And so they often will go down into some lower elevation habitat. And so today I'm just going to be talking about the emergence of some of that behavior in black-tailed deer in Josephine County. I'll give you an introduction into black-tailed deer, their importance to the county, the importance of deer winter range to the county. And then I'll really just jump right into our research project, which involved in very simple details of catching a bunch of deer, putting radio collars on them, letting them go, and then just watching where they went. We monitored them. We did observe some changes in elevation in our black-tailed deer herd. It is a very complicated method. It's not just a simple story like it is in Jackson County. They did use some designated habitat. We'll talk about that and get into a few conclusions. One thing I'm not going to do a lot of tonight is provide recommendations on possible changes to a code. What we'll do, what agencies usually do, is wait for recommendations, proposed changes to be generated, and then we'll provide comments on that. So some of the stuff I talk about just naturally will lend itself to some recommendations, but in the end, mostly I'm going to be kind of mute on whatever you're doing, and we'll wait to see what you guys have come up with and provide a comment at that time. So basically, this obviously map of Oregon, it's a map of the different ecoregions. The primary ones for our area are the West Cascades, the Coast Range, and then where Josephine County is in Jackson County. Really, you can see the outline there. Josephine County, of course, the one on the left to the west. And if you can get that outline in your head, that might help you orient yourself with some later maps as well. And really, we're in the Klamath Mountains ecoregion, which is a very interesting place. It's got a lot of really special things going on. The plant diversity here is just amazing. One of the things about the Klamath that is a little odd is they tend to run more east-west, where the Cascades are kind of running north-south. So biologically, that can mean some different things as far as having north and south facing slopes, things like that. But so just to outline again, Grants Pass, Cave Junction, to the major cities here. And this, what you're looking at here is what we call a digital elevation model. And it basically just shows you the topography of the area in a very dramatic way. The white, of course, is high elevation area. The darker the color, the lower it is. And you can see when you look into the eastern side of Jackson County into the Cascade Mountains, there is just a ton of real high elevation habitat. And then down Mount Ashland, that 50 summit area, quite a bit. And then once you get over into Josephine County, there's really not as much. And the main part is the ridgeline coming out of California that kind of goes north and then hooks to the right and comes into Grayback Mountain. And that's where you get most of your high elevation stuff.
Are those dots just like towns?
Yeah, those dots are just towns. So, you know, if you know the area, you can kind of pick out which ones they are. And then there, you can see a faint gray line. Those are the major roads. So this is a map of the winter range designated in Jackson County and in Josephine County. In Jackson County, they took a much more nuanced look at their winter range than what was done in Josephine County. They really, biologists with our agency, somewhat painstakingly cobbled together aerial photos into these big mosaics, and they went and they used topographic lines to trace topographic features, but they also went around specific brush fields, and they really spent a lot of time specifically looking at not just elevation, but other types of habitat features. The red dots that you see there are deer locations. We collared, ODFW collared a bunch of deer in the late 90s to try and figure out what the causes of mortality, why they were dying, and black-tailed deer. So those red dots represent the locations of those deer during the warm months of the year, the summer season. The blue dots represent the winter season. And you can see it's a pretty good correspondence to the winter range overlay. And actually, you can notice some of those deer down in California there, the blue dots to the south. We actually run two or three different spring surveys. We drive into California, hike up from Iron Gate Reservoir, and do some all-day hikes around and have some of our best long-term data from doing that. So deer harvest, this is just one way you can look at the history of a game animal is to see the harvest. Of course, there's a lot of other things that go into it. How many people are hunting, different technologies can improve their efficiency, the age demographics even of your hunting population can affect your harvest rate. But what I really want to point out to you right now is if you see that big dramatic dip right before 1970 in the late 1960s, mm-hmm. what that is some really hard winters. We had some tremendous winters back then, and I understand from reading some of the documents that that really hammered our deer herd. They really suffered a lot. We really haven't seen that type of dramatic winter since I've been here in the last 7 years. Now, generally, the deer herd has kind of, in the mid-90s, really started to drop off. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Of course, there's more development. There's more disease concerns. We have a disease called adenovirus. We have a hair loss syndrome from a parasitic louse that probably comes from Europe or Asia. So we've got a lot of other things we're dealing with. But the most important thing is probably when the Northwest Forest Plan was passed, a lot of logging on federal land stopped. And logging, not so good for spotted owls, but pretty good for deer, really. Especially if you don't spray afterwards. It creates a lot of what we call early cereal stage habitat. And that habitat really generates a lot of brush, those deciduous plants that those deer need to eat. So once the forest plan stopped, you know, it takes 5-10 years for those clear cuts that were generated before 1994, and then after that, they kind of grow up, and you can kind of see this gradual driving down of the deer herd. The other thing I should mention is, of course, most of us are familiar with Measure 18, the law that banned the use of hounds to hunt cougars and bears, and that is right, the decline in deer starts right before that ban took place. So we got more cougars, we got more bears out in the woods, too. Our office checked in. Well, actually, we got to brag a little bit. Our local office checked in 100 more bears this past hunting season than any other office in the state. The bear hunting down here lately has just been amazing. But they do eat some fawns, and they do prey on deer. So, Josephine County, let me see if I can lower this. This is gauche. Josephine County has a little bit different protection measures than Jackson County. It was painted with more of a broad brush. Critical habitat consisted of land below 2,500 feet in elevation that were not already impacted by development. And the other thing that's a little different, in Jackson County, the development standard is in what they call sensitive winter range, which here, let me back up just for a second. So, Josephine County, you see the color there, and you see how it extends into Jackson County? Mm-hmm. That is the same density limitation. That's what, in Jackson County, they call sensitive habitat. And in Jackson County, it's one house per 40 acres. And the way they interpret that, or the way they've written it, is that if you have an 80-acre lot, you can subdivide it into two lots. If you have a 120-acre lot, you can subdivide it into three lots. If you have a 39-acre lot, you can't subdivide. So that's a little different than the code in Josephine County, which is a bit more ambiguous and can sometimes be a little harder to interpret, although I think we've cleaned a lot of that up with the revision that took place a few years ago. Residential density is restricted to one dwelling per 40 acres within any 2 square miles of land. So 32 dwellings per 2 square miles of land. And that gives you that density. It's still one house per 40 acres, but the way it's interpreted and implemented is a lot different. And there's probably pluses and some minuses to that. Winter range, I got a few slides in here I just want to point out, doesn't just protect deer. We've got a lot of sensitive species in the state of Oregon. One of the planning efforts that my agency has been through is the conservation strategy for Oregon. And through that process, we've identified what are called strategy habitats on a statewide basis. Oak woodlands, ponderosa pine woodlands, riparian habitat, and grasslands. All those habitat types occur within deer winter range. We've also, in that planning process, identified areas called conservation opportunity areas. And those are just places on the landscape that, due to a confluence of strategy habitats, sensitive species, or on-the-ground habitat work, the idea is if you can get people to do habitat improvement works in those conservation opportunity areas, you can kind of have a synergistic effect if everybody's kind of working closely geographically together. So 33% of those conservation opportunity areas in Josephine County occur on winter range. That doesn't mean anything development-wise. The conservation opportunity areas are areas to do volunteer habitat improvement work, but they do kind of just give you some measure of the important habitat that is out there. There's also a lot of strategy species. These are not quite synonymous with what we call sensitive species in the past, but Pacific fisher, a species I'm also doing some other research on right now, ringtail, blue-gray gnatcatcher, Lewis woodpecker, whitehead woodpecker, some birds that are really associated with that oak component. We've got a variety of different herps, reptiles, and amphibians, and some sensitive plant species as well. I did some mapping before I came here, and if you look at the winter range habitat as a whole, it provides habitat to a great deal of animals that are either listed as critical or vulnerable on our state sensitive species list, or they're actually endangered or threatened. So that's what that table is on the bottom. And so we've got 2 threatened vertebrate animals, 4 that are listed as sensitive critical, 19 listed as sensitive vulnerable, and then a variety of vascular plants that are also either threatened or endangered. But that's not really my specialty, but I just have the information, so I thought I'd present it. So deer also, in addition to just their conservation value, their inherent value as a species, they have a real economic value. There's some dollars here. In 2009, 8,578 hunters spent almost 57,000 days, 100 days. And what that is if one hunter goes hunting 3 days, that's 300 days. So that's how 8,500 people can scale up to 56,000 days. And that's in the wildlife management units in Josephine County. So not all of that was in Josephine County because our wildlife management units don't perfectly match the county. But a good chunk of it did take place in Josephine County. In 2008, hunters contributed approximately $2,300,000 to Josephine County's local economy. Now, we know that because our agency, in cooperation with the federal agencies started doing some economic wildlife surveys, and I can give you the reference for that if you're interested. And that is just hunting. Now, if you take in fishing and bird watching and all the non-consumptive uses, and actually hunting is probably one of the smaller pieces of that wildlife economy pie, it starts getting into real big money. Not to mention the recreational value that a lot of our citizens have. I think it's fair to say that black-tailed deer are important, not just economically, but just culturally to Josephine County. It's a real important game species. So what do we want to look at? I mean, there's a lot of different things you can research with deer or other ungulates or game mammals, but we wanted to look at a few things that could specifically maybe help with some of the planning issues that have come up over time in Josephine County. So we had two main questions. We wanted to break it into kind of understandable chunks. So our two questions are, first of all, do deer migrate? Do they move at all from high elevation areas to lower elevation areas? And secondly, do they use areas designated as deer winter range in Josephine County? So you could theoretically have deer move but not use habitat that you've designated. One thing to point out is that a lot of the, if you look at some of the background information in Josephine County's documents and ODFW documents, a lot of the impetus for implementing winter range had to do with those crashes in the late 60s in the deer population, is to protect the deer herd in those years that there is extreme weather events. So just keep that in mind as well. In Jackson County, it's a little different. We knew we had this exceedingly migratory herd, and so bad weather or not, they need to have that winter range intact. In Josephine County, there's probably some deer moving with the thought, but mostly it's for protection of that, from that really harsh winter. So again, here is a variation of our digital elevation model. This time, I've had it broken out, so it's not just continuous. It's in chunks, so you can just kind of get a more generalized view of the county. Again, the high elevation stuff is that Great Back Mountain area coming down to the California border. So what we did in 2005 is we went out, drove around in the woods, found game trails, and started putting out a lot of salt. We did that in five different areas. We actually did it in six, but we didn't really catch any deer in one, so that can't analyze much there. But Chan Creek drainage, Savage Creek, Munger Butte between Williams and Murphy, the north side of Grayback Mountain, and then most recently in 2008, we caught some deer in the Bolin Lake area, way down on the southern end of the county, right up against the California border. So this is the kind of trap we used. It's called a clover trap. What it is, it's a metal trap, metal frame trap. It's got these flexible mesh fabric panels in it. And the neat thing about this trap is that it collapses. If you get a deer in it, you can fold the whole trap back on top of the deer, and that way it restrains the animal. The things you got to watch out for is when you're folding that trap back, just like anything else that folds, it creates some pretty strong pinch points with a lot of torque. So you want to make sure that you don't get your fingers in there and the deer's leg isn't in there. In the first year we trapped, we used drugs. We would put them down in this and we drug the deer, and they would go under. But we had some problems getting them to come back out of the drug-induced state. And so after the first year, we decided no more drugs, and we just basically physically restrained the deer, which can be kind of exciting. And this is the camera that we set up on the trap. You can see a deer going inside right now. And actually, once we put these cameras, it was kind of interesting. We found out that some nights a deer would go in the trap, get some salt, come back out, not trigger the trap. And, well, that one's gone, another deer would come in and actually catch the, and we'd catch that deer. So, kind of interesting. But it would go in. There's a little fishing line tripwire in the back. We usually kind of set it up in an X. The deer pulls that fishing line, it pulls out a cotter pin, and then that door shuts behind it. And usually they run around a little bit and try and get out. So you can see here, this is my friend John. He was a volunteer with us that helped us with this. He's laying on top of the deer right there. You can see all the trap leans back. The unfortunate part is that usually you have to go through a couple of iterations of it, because even though the trap leans back, usually the deer runs to the far back end of the trap, and you got to lift it up a little bit, get him to go to the front, lean it back down again. And it's just, it can be just a lot of work, and it's a lot of fun, though, too. So we do a variety of things with the deer. Once we get them collared, of course, we put a radio transmitter on the deer. We blindfold them. That tends to calm them down. Most animals, if you put a blindfold on them, tends to calm them down quite a bit. We'll put an ear tag in them. In case they lose the collar, we might be able to identify a deer if somebody sees the ear tag. And we draw blood. We send that off to our state wildlife veterinarian. He keeps it just as basically background information. So sometime years from now, if we have some disease outbreak, he can go back into those blood samples and look to see if there were antibodies for it prior to the outbreak that maybe we just didn't know about. So just another image of us holding the deer down. You can see there, the collar is a little different. If you notice here, we've got a collar that's a thick, leathery, white plastic material. And down here, we've got a collar that's just basically elastic in a Cordura case. And the reason we do that is when we put the collars on an animal like a buck, their necks are going to swell up during the rut. And sometimes their young animals are just going to grow, too. So we want to make sure that our collars aren't going to choke them later on. And once we've got these collars out, basically then we hop in the plane with OSP. Our Oregon State Police officers have some planes, and they let us to fly with them. The neat thing about these planes, and the way this works, is there's on each wing, there's a radio antenna. You can see the antenna there. And what we do when we're flying around is we have a switcher box where we can switch from the left side of the plane to the right side of the plane. And those collars are sending out a signal at 50 beats per second. So they're just beep, beep, beep. And you're flipping from one side of the plane to the other. And whatever side of the plane has a louder signal, you tell the pilot to go that way. And then if he goes past it, you tell him to go the other way. So you just keep correcting until you're flying straight at where the signal is coming from or where you think the signal is coming from. And then in a perfect world, the signal gets louder and louder and louder until you pass over the deer and then it drops off. And then you do a circle and you do the same sort of thing, correcting left and right until you're flying in a straight line. Where those two lines cross, that should be the location of the deer, and you punch in on your GPS unit that now I think I'm over the deer. But, of course, in the real world, you have canyons, you have cover, you have collars that may not be working perfectly, you have shorts that occur in the electrical equipment. So there's all sorts of this stuff you're trying to navigate in the cockpit of this plane, and you're talking to the pilot, and it can be real fun. And there's a variation in OSP pilots. For some pilots, hard turn right means one thing. For other pilots, hard turn right means something completely different. And if you're not careful which pilot you're with, you could have an upset stomach. So really, the main variable I talked about in that first question was elevation. We wanted to take a look at elevation. So what we did is we ended up capturing 46 deer. We were only able to use 31 in our analysis, and that's because sometimes these deer slip their radio collar off, they kick it, comes off. They're no longer in our sample. Sometimes they die before. Because what we wanted were deer that survived from a summer to a winter. And sometimes in the fall, they would die. Sometimes they'd get shot by a hunter and he'd bring us the collar. And say, here, I think this is yours. Statistically, the sample unit that we used is an individual deer. We used that digital elevation model I showed you earlier to append elevation data to all those telemetry locations. And we define winter basically very broadly as November to April, and summer as May to October. And we kind of let the deer help us do that. We watched when they moved, and that kind of told us when their season of using winter range was. So then for each season, we calculated the mean or average for each individual deer for each season. And then we subtracted the winter mean elevation from the summer mean elevation for each deer. And conducted a paired t-test. And basically, it's just a way to tell if these numbers are actually different. Because the important thing anytime you're doing a study is not just are the numbers different, they're always going to be different, but are they statistically significant in their difference? So, and in our study, they were. Overall mean elevation of collared deer did decline from summer until winter. So overall, when you took all the deer and you pooled them together, in the wintertime, we would find them at a slightly lower elevation on average than they were found in the summer. However, that mean elevation was still above the 2,500-foot benchmark that we used to designate deer winter range in Josephine County. However, we really need to dig in a little deeper because the means can hide a lot of variability. For example, you know, in this room, there's a mean income that we all have. If you took all of our incomes and averaged it, we'd have a mean income. But if Bill Gates walked into the room, suddenly that mean income is going to be a lot higher, but I'm not any richer. So within these means, there's a lot of variability. One of the sources of variability is differences between years. I really should have stopped the study on the fourth year because I had such a nice pattern going. It was up in the summer, down, 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 until our fifth year, where the mean winter elevation was actually higher than it was in the summer. There's a couple things going on. In that fifth year of our study, basically due to other OSP priorities, like I could only get that plane twice down here. So we only got two flights, which isn't very much. The other thing is that we hadn't captured deer that year, and most of our deer were surviving still from the first year. So we have this constant attrition rate where our sample size is getting smaller. So there's a few things just to keep in the back of your head when you look at that final year. But when you pool everything together, even with that final year, that's kind of odd, there's still that mean statistically significant decrease in elevation. Individual deer also behave different. So we had variation within years, but we also had variation just amongst the deer herd. It wasn't like all of the deer just moved down that mean level. What really happened is we had almost 20% of our deer are what we call obligate migrators. That's deer that behave like they do in Jackson County. They have a high elevation summer range. They go down to a low elevation winter range. They spend all winter down there. These are separate areas, sometimes as far as 7 to 10 miles apart, and then it moves back up the hill back to its summer range. We also have deer we refer to as facultative migrators, and what that means is they move, but it's not really a true migration like you see in Jackson County to a separate winter range. They're just making, say they live on Grayback Mountain, they're just going 150 feet lower, just getting maybe out of the snow line, maybe getting to where there's still some more vegetation. Maybe they're just getting into some oak habitat that has some acorns there. So we got our obligate, our facultative, and then 48.3% of our deer were just simply residents. Be it rain or shine, snow falling, whatever, they stayed basically in the same spot. So we had all of this variation, and it somewhat depends on which area you caught the deer in. It makes some sense, the composition of the herd. However, in Grayback Mountain, we caught two deer in this exact same trap. One of those deer moved all the way down to the Williams Valley, stayed there, like I said, all year, and then came back to its summer range in the summer. The other deer was resident. Same elevation it was caught at. It stayed on the north side of Grayback Mountain all winter long. So these behaviors are really interesting and very different. And whenever you have a species, sometimes having different behaviors can be really good. It's kind of like not putting all your eggs in one basket. Because when all the deer move down, maybe something's wrong with the winter range, and there's a problem there. If all the deer stay up, they're going to be all affected by that harsh winter. But having a mixture of these behaviors might evolutionarily serve a purpose. But that's just sort of wild conjecture, and you know, I can't really support that. It's just a concept. So again, we had our resident, our facultative migrators, and our obligate migrators. So the reddish color, that is the elevation those deer were at on their summer range. The blue column is their elevation on the winter range. And so you can see residential deer, deer we define as residents, really there's no difference fundamentally. Facultative migrators, you're starting to see some downward movement during the winter. But where you get the big change, the Bill Gates, if you will, of this example are these obligate migrators. These are the ones that are really exhibiting that migratory response. So, if you remember, our first question was, do the deer migrate? Well, it's one of those yes, but. You know, they do. Some of them do, but some of them don't. So there's a very complicated thing going on there. The other question, the other fundamental question was, do they use winter range? Areas that have been mapped as the county. So again, 36 deer, 31, an analysis, winter, summer. Basically, it was pretty simple. We imported our location back into the GIS. We imported the winter range map, and then we just classified them as inside winter range or outside winter range. And calculated the percentage of use for individual deer, and then the percentage of total locations during the winter that occurred on winter range. So this is just a map showing you all of the locations in throughout the county. Summer is red. Those red dots will always be summer. The blue dots are winter. And it's a little misleading because there's actually a lot of blue dots stacked directly underneath some of the red dots right now. So you just can't see those. But those are, so I take away the red dots. Those now are all the winter locations. So you can kind of, if you remember from the previous map, north of Wilderville, that's our Shan Creek area. Across from Murphy to the east, that's Savage Creek. Down in Williams, that area that's to the west is what we call Munger Butte. And then the area at the top of Caves Creek, due east from Holland, that's our Grayback area. And the ones right on the southern boundary, those are Bolin Lake. Yes?
You selected certain areas to do this, obviously. What is your estimate in each of these areas of how many square miles those deer represent? I mean, you're only sampling a percentage of the county for obvious reasons, but when you set a crap up, are you expecting that's a sample that you can say covers a 10-square-mile area?
I probably wouldn't put it per square mile. I would phrase it more as it represents a portion of the deer population. So, you know, we have 31 deer. There's thousands of deer out there, tens of thousands probably, throughout the county. So any one deer is representing multiple thousands of other deer that we didn't sample. But I don't think you'd want to say it represents, you know, a 10-mile area, because within that 10-mile area, even the deer that we caught behave differently. So I think it's more informative to think of it as far as the deer representing a portion of the population.
I got questions, Lon.
Sure.
You're answering. So we got six deer in the obligatory type, right?
Right.
How significant is that statistically, thousands and thousands of deer to only have six in that one?
Well, it's, you know, the thing about this is that there's really no confidence intervals or anything wrapped around that. It's not a statistical number. It's more of a descriptive number. So I would say that there are probably thousands of deer that behave like that. I'm going to show you in a minute different proportions in the different behavior types. That's within our sample. I would expect that I don't think there was any biases. Like, I don't think we were more likely to catch obligate deer than residential deer in an area. There's nothing that's biasing our data in that way.
Right.
But it's a small sample size.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you would have had enough money to get another six deer in that set, and that would have significantly changed those conclusions.
I think it would. Yeah, I mean, it probably would. But so what I guess is not so much the percentages that are there, but just the fact that all these different behaviors occurred would probably be informative. So now these are just the winter locations that occurred on winter.
Another question.
Oh, yeah.
It looked to me, if I was reading correctly, that most of your studies involve these 3,000 to 4,000 foot elevation.
Yeah, a little higher than that, but 3,500 to 4,500, yeah.
anything done at lower elevation?
No, not really. We're pretty sure that we know that there's residential deer. We did most of our capturing in the summertime on the summer range because that's what we thought we would actually have. What we really wanted to do was document the migratory behavior of those higher elevation deer. And so that's why we did our capturing on the summertime. You can't really capture up there in the winter because they're, you know, close to snow. And then on the winter range, we're very comfortable with the fact that there are residential deer in all those areas. You can go out there, the Williams Valley, drive out in the middle of the summer, you can find deer. So we thought that if we captured deer in the summertime on the lower elevation stuff, we might have a lot of difficulty picking up those migratory deer.
So there really is no study done at the lower elevations of the county?
No. No.
Do we have any idea what percentage of the deer are residential at the lower elevation?
Well, we have. Well, I think if you go down Williams Valley and you're finding deer there in the summer, they're probably resident there all year round because they're not going to migrate back up the hill in the winter. And we do some summer spotlight routes, and we see a lot of deer on the valley floor in the summer. So there's no, we didn't collar any deer, but I don't necessarily think that we need to. We know that there's residential deer there.
But what I'm trying to get at is what percentage does the migratory deer represent of the whole deer population?
Mm-hmm. And that, I can't say. What I can tell you is the percentage of those deer above 2,500 feet.
But we're not seeing much migratory patterns getting below 2,500 feet.
Well, yeah, hold on a minute. There, you'll get a little more.
How much did it cost just to do the 31?
A lot.
I'm just curious because, you know, I mean, 31 is not very many samples, you know, and I was thinking, you know, I mean, if you had 250, you know, I could see that as being more representative of...
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you.
Statistically.
Unfortunately,
but what would you guess 31 cost?
Oh, man, I couldn't guess, to be honest with you.
Do they have numbers like that?
Well, I could probably go, I mean, I can't guess right now. I could go back to the office and look at my timesheets and maybe figure it out, but it's expensive. Not just expensive in dollar terms, but in terms of our time. Because we, you know, before we started this project, I had a full-time job. We started this project, and then we decided we should also relocate a bunch of elk. So we were doing that, and now we've got a rabies outbreak in Cave Junction, so I'm doing that. So it's expensive not just in the terms of finances, but of, you know, our ability to do the work. So
does that go for, like, the spotted owl inventories, too?
Well, our agency doesn't do spotted owl inventories. A lot of the spotted owl inventory stuff has more direct funding because they have that threatened status.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So it's done federally?
Yeah, most of it. A lot of it is done privately, and there is some stuff done on state forestry land, but ODFW, our agency, doesn't really do much of it. Okay. It's mostly tied to the timber industry or to the federal monitoring. Let me move on here. I just want to get through some things in case people have to take off, and then I'll be happy to take any questions people have. But so these are the winter locations that occur on winter range. And so the things to point out here are that most of our migratory behavior really came out of that area in the southwest corner or southeast corner of the county, the grayback area. And so you can see south of Tequilma, we have a few dots. Those deer moved approximately 10, or that deer moved approximately 10 miles from the Bowen Lake area. Made a really dramatic downhill movement. Those dots in Williams, that's a truly migratory deer. That deer, or there's actually two or three of them down there. The top of Caves Creek, we had some real strong annual migration there. And then some in Shan Creek, too. Over by Savage Creek, you see a few points. However, that doesn't, in that area, doesn't necessarily indicate that those are winter, true migratory or animals using winter range as winter range, because these are actually summer locations on the winter range. That Savage Creek area, there's just not a lot of upper elevation habitat, so they kind of roam around in a lot of that.
That's my place, and I don't see any deer. So.
Well, actually, Savage Creek was the area we had we caught 8 deer there, I think, in like 4 days with 5 traps, where some of the other areas, I actually set a trap was walking up the hill with all my gear, and I watched the deer walk into that trap. It was incredible. We caught deer at an astounding rate in that area. Grayback Mountain, we had quite a few traps set up there. We had a trap line of about 14, and we'd catch 2 to 3 deer in a week. So these areas differ, too, just in our ability to catch deer. So overall, winter range use, and again, it's just to address some of the questions, it is the deer population that is over 2,500 feet. 45% of collared deer use designated deer winter range during the winter season. 15% of all telemetry locations occurred on winter range during the winter season. So again, it's that sort of yes but thing. Deer are using winter range on an annual basis, but it's that relatively small, the area within our sample population, about 20% of the deer are those obligate migrators. So just to refresh a little bit, our 5 capture areas were Savage Creek, the Red Dots, Shan Creek, the Blue Dots over in the northwest corner, Munger Butte, which is the kind of yellow, olive-colored running along that ridge between Williams and Selma. The green dots are capture sites for our grayback deer, and then those blue dots are our traps that we use for our Bolin Lake area. And these are maps tuned in just a little bit tighter so you can see what's going on. This is our Bolin Lake area. We had 2 deer that stayed up high the whole winter long, and then we had 1 deer that moved a very substantial distance down to spend the whole winter on that piece of winter range you see just below O'Brien there. And then the following summer, it moved all the way back up to Bolin Lake. So it has that classic obligate migratory behavior. And then all 3 of those deer died that year. So they lived 1 year after we captured them. So I'm pretty sure, you know, if they live a year, it's probably nothing we did to them. They survived a long time. And then the next year, they all died as soon as they summer. And they died in the summer. It was the weirdest thing.
Hunger disease.
So here is where we caught a lot of our deer, the Grayback area, the Munger Butte area, Caves Creek in that Williams area there, and a little bit at the top of Deer Creek is really where a lot of our migrating deer, where they use the habitat during the wintertime. And if you see that one red dot in amongst all the blue down by Caves Creek, that is one of those points that's screwing up that graph in that 5th year, in that that's a deer that was migratory the whole time. I did my 1 flight in the winter, and for whatever reason, it was down there. And it completely flipped its normal behavior on that particular day. And so anyway, that's what you get when you have really small opportunity to fly. This is Savage Creek, and so you can kind of see that there is some blue dots on winter range, but there's also red dots on winter range, and there's blue dots throughout the summer range. These deer in this area really weren't very strongly migratory at all. They kind of utilized that habitat all year. That's not to say if we got a super hard winter, maybe they would move down. If we had deer dying like they did in 1968 everywhere because of the snow, then maybe there'd be an issue. But on an annual basis, they're not really showing us much.
At least I know I got 1 deer living on my place.
So this is Shan Creek. You can see the Rogue River down there, Riverbanks Drive. And most of these deer were more of the facultative sort, kind of making a downward shift, but not necessarily. I think we had 1 deer that was probably what you could call a true migrator. It moved to a different area and moved back up again. But most of it was just this kind of little shift down when the weather got cold.
Now, can you tell what deer going up and down or not?
You mean individual deer?
Yeah.
We each caller, and I should have mentioned that. Thanks for asking. Each caller emits an individual radio frequency, so we can identify individual deer. That's what allows me to classify them, you know, individually as residents, obligate migrators.
Is there any? Probably with the number you have, you probably couldn't do this, but any kind of correlate between bucks and does?
I know
would tend to roam around a heck of a lot more than the does would.
We looked at that, but there really isn't much of a relationship, and I think it does have probably more to do with our sample size. It's tough to say. I can show you the graph, but I just don't know how informative it is, really. It probably doesn't mean much. And part of it is because we caught a lot. Because you have a sample size, you wind up with things like, well, just coincidentally, a lot of our does were caught at higher elevation than our bucks were. So then that skews everything, you know, on a sex basis. Oh. So what we have here, again, the reddish bar is summer, the bluish bar is winter. On the bottom, you have the number of deer captured. So 7 in Savage Creek, 5 in Shannon Creek, 8 in Munger Butte and Grayback, and 3 in Bolin Lake. And you can kind of see that again, the Savage Creek area, there's really no difference. A bit more of a difference in Shan Creek, a little bit of a difference in Munger Butte. You're starting to get more of a difference in Grayback and then Bolin Lake. And these are averages, though, keep in mind. So we had, in an area like Bolin Lake, we caught 3 deer. 1 deer moved, the other 2 didn't. So averages can be, you know, can only tell you so much.
If you were under 2,500 feet, say from 1,400 to 2,500 feet, what do you hypothesize that the difference would have been in numbers?
You mean if we caught them in the summertime or in the wintertime?
In the summertime.
Well, in the summertime, if you're down that low in the summertime, I'd say 99% of those deer would be residents. If you're down there in the wintertime, then you're going to have a mixture of those deer that have moved down from the high country. What that overall composition is, I couldn't say.
And have they done those studies anywhere in the state on any deer wind range?
Sure. Actually, a lot of the way research, the more typical way this is done is often to catch deer on their low elevation area. But when you have limited funding and you want to see if they're migratory, you might wade through a lot of residential deer, especially in an area like the Williams Valley. And those aren't really the deer that we're trying to protect that habitat for. You know, the deer that really need it are those ones that have to get out of the high country. So, but yeah, actually, there's been quite a bit of research done, and a lot of it is different. The Coast Range has largely showed that non-migratory deer. Deer in the Coast Range tend to be very residential. Deer in the Cascades sometimes show migratory behavior, like we've seen with the Jackson County deer. But then just on the other side, in the Umpqua drainage, they collared a bunch of deer, and they really didn't move very much. So it can vary. Oh, so I forgot to make my point. So basically, this is just another look at the composition from each area of the, you know, how we have classified these deer. So we've got our obligate migrators, our residential deer, and then that facultative migratory response.
Got a question here?
Yeah.
On the Shan Creek one, you're showing 20% being obligate. And as I recall, I think the previous panel said that there were 5 deer. So what you're talking about is you're projecting that area having 20% necessarily based on 1 deer.
Well, again, remember, this is 20% of our sample. And this is,
which was 5.
Which was 5, yep. Small sample size, right. So, let's see, elevation. Again, we've got a very high elevation area to the east of Jackson County. We've got that really well-developed migratory response. And then in Johnston County here, we've just got that area in the Grayback Mountain where that's where most of our migratory deer that actually migrate that we were able to show are coming out of. So I think a lot of it has to do with just the difference in topography between the two counties.
Was your sample larger in Jackson?
Well, on a higher elevation.
Yeah, the sample was a lot higher in Jackson County. That was a full-on research project run out of our wildlife research lab at Roseburg. So they caught like 120 deer or something like that. Yeah.
It seems like the place where the deer are, there's more of the obligate migrators is
is at a higher elevation than the other places, so maybe that kind of correlates with what's going on in Jackson County, and maybe the deer that's naturally somewhere at a higher elevation migrate more than the rest, because we don't have that much high elevation in this county.
I think that's right. Where you have your higher elevation area, and I think you may have just made my next point when I was coming up. Yeah, but where you have your high elevation area, I think that is where you're going to have more of that obligate migratory response.
I got a question for you. Yep. What about, have they done any correlation in logging in the last 30 years and deer populations?
There's a big history of deer research has to do with documenting logging and its effect on deer, and that's pretty well understood.
Including the migration?
Not so much including the migration. There's been some work done that shows that deer are very stubborn, I guess you'd say. When they have a winter range develop deer in other areas, even if you alter that habitat dramatically, there's been documented cases where deer will still go to that site. I'm thinking of some places in Alaska where in their area, winter range really has a lot to do with developed timber to protect thermal cover. And they've had areas where they logged off the area and the deer kept going into the clear cuts even though there wasn't any thermal cover there anymore. And there's been other research that documented deer being very stubborn, sticking to specific migration routes, sticking to specific migration trails, even to the point when reservoirs have been built that cut off migration routes. There's now cases where deer swim the reservoir. I think there's even been some anecdotal stuff about Lost Creek when they
I've actually seen them swimming across the lake.
Yeah, so they can be pretty stubborn.
It's weird. You don't think they're going to make it, and they do.
Mm-hmm. So, did deer migrate? Yes, but, you know, just to roughly, half the deer made some sort of winter adjustment if you include the obligate and the facultative, but half the deer are pretty residential. Do migratory deer use winter range from these high elevation deer? Yes, but again, half the deer were using the habitat at least once, but a big chunk of them were actually residential. So the thing is, and I fully accept the points that have been made about sample size. I mean, the sample size is what it is. It's low. And so it's not, so you can put a little bit of stock in those percentages to some extent. I think there is a relationship between whether a deer is going to be migratory or not based on how high the elevation of its summer range is. But you can't say a lot more than that. They are really small sample sizes. The interesting thing and the message to convey, I think, is just that more than the percentages, that all of these behaviors did occur. You know, we documented all of these behaviors occurring. So that said, yeah.
So is this an ongoing project where you continue to do this now that you know the behaviors occur? And it seems like it would be prohibitively expensive to really increase the sample size to make it statistically significant. Is there any purpose in continuing spending the money doing this now that we know that the behaviors occur but we can't get a statistically significant sample?
Well, it depends how you mean statistically significant. I mean, I don't think we can say definitively that, you know, all these deer have this percentage necessarily. But we can say things about their change in mean elevation. But no, we're probably not going to continue the research. We've got some callers out there still. We'll continue monitoring them. We will follow them, but probably I don't think we're planning to start catching more deer. If we do, we would probably move into other areas to see if we would find similar things. So 19% of collared deer moved at least 900 feet lower in elevation. We did have that chunk of the deer that were very strongly migratory. The majority of collared deer either did not move or they just made sort of a seasonal adjustment. Designated winter range was not used by all deer, but it's probably important to those deer that did move.
Could you explain why there is so much more of a percentage of deer winter range in Josephine County than any of the other counties on the west side of the Cascades?
I don't
it really is significant. A significant more deer winter range in Josephine County than the other counties, the 18 counties on the west side of the Cascades.
I guess I'd have to look into that a little bit more. You certainly don't have more than in Jackson County.
On a percentage basis?
I can answer on a percentage basis. On an acreage basis, no, I don't think that you do. And I believe there are... I'm not so familiar with areas outside of my watershed, so I'd have to look into it some more, and I can do that.
Could you do that?
Yeah,
that would be interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
A question while he's on that. We're seeing all these, Bolin and Chaney and Bear Shan Creek and all these are. But what I'd really like to see is an overlay of the impacted deer winter range with those on. So where is my impacted area in reference to where you're tagging?
Okay, we can go back to some maps and maybe inform you of that a little bit more. But let me get through a few things and I'll kind of be done, and then if people need to leave, they can, and I'll take more questions.
No, they can't leave till later.
Oh, yeah.
So we're just dismissed.
They bolted the doors closed when you came in.
Well, that's generally good in preparation of one of my thoughts.
Oh.
I appreciate that. So Caves Creek, Sucker Creek, Deer Creek, Williams Creek, and the Illinois Valley, basically those areas surrounding that grayback area, I think are probably the more high-priority areas. Not just based on our collars, because obviously there's a lot of areas that we didn't sample, but kind of taking some best guesses, extrapolating a little bit on where that high elevation habitat is. One thing to note, sort of a footnote here, is we did not experience a heavy winter kill while conducting this study. So it wasn't one of those 1968 years. You know, it's just sort of normal background years. In addition to the small sample size, if we had had a year, we were getting calls from all over Jackson and Josephine County about people finding dead deer, then, you know, the results could be different from that. So winter range could be important even to those deer that we described as residential if they have that kind of abnormal, that really super harsh winter. So I think, yeah, that's it. That's my talk. So I would be happy to take some questions.
You talked about 43%, you were giving certain figures on use of designated winter range.
Right.
And one of these that is in Josephine as low as 2,500 feet.
Right.
But your study all indicated results over 3,000 feet.
Well, no.
So how did you...
Remember again, that's the average. The average is over 3,500 feet. But these deer... Here, I'll show you if I can. Well, sorry. Yeah, so look in the Williams Valley there.
Uh-huh.
Those are all deer that are below 2,500 feet now. Those deer in Caves Creek, those are below, the ones that are actually in the dark colored area, those are below 2,500 feet. So they're actually on winter range.
So
we're
the ones in
Williams this study?
Yes, this is all part of this study.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
The ones in William are resident at that elevation, though, aren't they?
No, maybe I didn't understand. Mm-hmm. I guess I didn't explain satisfactorily. They were caught. You see all where all those red dots are, Grayback Mountain?
No.
That's where our capture site was. Those deer moved from there down to there and then came back up again.
Okay, I see.
And same with the Caves Creek, and same for those few points down in Deer Creek.
How low did they go? Mm-hmm.
Right to the river?
They went pretty low. I mean, I have it in the computer. I can dig it out for you, but I'd say probably, you know, down to 1,700, something like that, before I remember.
I'm trying to get a feel for how the deer are affected in the ranges in which development may be allowed to occur below 2,500 feet.
Right.
So this committee, that's what
it seems to. When I said obligate deer, when I said those 20%, those are deer that are moving into that winter range. They're moving into that area. Where they mostly occurred was you would find them in the summer in Grayback Mountain, but then in the wintertime you would find those deer in the Williams Valley and the Deer Creek Valley and Caves Creek in those areas below 2,500 feet.
But not much below 2,500 feet.
No. So that deer down in the Williams Valley, that's clear on the valley floor. That deer...
At one.
Well, yeah, but they're only
And then this deer here in Bowling Lake down there, that's pretty low elevation stuff over there as well. So the average of all the deer was like 3,500 feet, but there were a subsection of the deer population that were using very low areas. And, you know, as everybody pointed out, we've got a really small sample size.
So, okay. The $64,000 question is how much impact are we getting? And the elevation is below 2,500 feet, but this group is trying to designate whether to allow development to occur.
So those areas that, well, a couple things. Remember, first of all, we talked about the harsh winters, so we could assume that there's going to be more movement during those rough winters. But in a normal year, the highest priority parts of the winter range, of the area you're talking about, are those areas that I think are going to be below this Grayback Mountain area. That's where we documented that, what I called obligate migratory response. We don't have a lot of deer that did it, but we didn't call it very many deer. So Williams Valley, the Illinois Valley, Deer Creek, those are going to be probably your highest priority areas for conservation. The other area, Savage Creek, we had a lot less deer movement in there. So that area is probably on an annual basis not as important as, say, that stuff below Grayback.
So there's a wide variety, a very diverse situation within the county. We have this big, broad brush of all these properties that are below 2,500 feet and are designated deer wind range. You're getting a great deal of difference between one part of the county to another.
Yeah, I think so. Within our small test.
Okay, I'm gonna stop everything a minute here. I'd like to have the committee ask their questions first, and then if the people that are visiting have some questions, we'll allow that. But I'd like the committee to get some of their questions answered, because from a process standpoint, based upon what we've done today, I'd like to see us take some kind of action on it at our next meeting as to recommendations. So my feeling is, I think the gentleman's done an excellent job of giving us some information. If there is some recommendations to make in regards to changing our local ordinance in relationship to the deer winter range, I would say be prepared to take some kind of an action at our next meeting. So I'd like to get the committee members to ask their questions, and then I'll let folks outside of the committee ask the questions. And Jack had his hand up.
Jack.
And then Grace. Okay.
Did most of the migratory patterns happen on public land? Or was there a lot of overlap into private land?
I haven't looked at that, actually. Because within the winter range, of course, there's a lot of public property, and I haven't analyzed it in the terms of that. I could do that.
Okay.
I could
take that. That'd be good.
That would be good.
When is your next meeting?
It's in March.
In March? Okay. Yeah. I can do it before March. Let me...
Maybe even before that.
So yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Come up with that.
Yep. Are you going to take notes here? Good.
I took some bad notes.
No, that's fine.
You can send an email and tell them what you need.
Yeah, exactly. If I say I'll do something,
we can have a copy of that PowerPoint presentation, and he can send it to me, and I can send it out in color and distribute it.
Given the overall deer population, including the residential semi-tame deer that live in lowland gardens, versus those that might be candidates for migrating, how would you break that down? Is it a 50-50 split? Or?
Well, it's a little difficult to say. One of the reasons also that we, and I don't think I'd want to say it, because that would frankly be pretty guessing at it. One of the reasons we do the high elevation stuff, in addition to trying to get a hold of those deer that are really require winter range, the other reason is a lot of this stuff with winter range, and then just, it's not like with the spotted owl where we're trying to conserve species. What we're trying to do is also conserve that part of the herd that gets hunted most frequently. And so you've got all these deer on this. Not only do they need winter range because it's high elevation, they're coming out of the mountains, but these deer on the high elevation area, it's mostly public property. That's where a lot of people, you know, do a lot of their hunting. So those are kind of the two reasons we focus on the high elevation stuff. As far as the low elevation stuff, I'm trying to think of some way I could look at that without just guessing, which could be, we did do some summer spotlight routes. What I could do is see if we've done any summer spotlight routes in areas where we also do winter routes, and see if there's a big difference between the two, meaning that if you run your spotlights down a road in the summertime, you count 100 deer. You come back in the winter, and now there's 200 deer. Probably a lot of those have moved in. So I'll take a look at that and see if I can come up with some kind of, you know, again, it'll just be kind of the back of the napkin calculations, but I'll give you some information.
If the land for the residential deer developed, semi-developed, whatever, is providing whatever the deer need in the way of habitat, what is peculiar that the migratory deer need that the resident deer don't need?
Well, there's not anything peculiar about the deer. It probably gets down to the issue of carrying capacity. So say one piece of ground can support 40 deer. That's what carrying capacity is, and just the number of animals that a piece of ground can support. If it can support 40 deer, but 20 of them leave for half the year, then that area now can support more animals. So they're competing with one another, and one of the ways they can get around that competition is to exploit all the habitat. So as I understood the question is, if the habitat is good year-round on the winter range, really why do you need a deer to leave to go up to the summer range? And I think it's just because...
No. That's not what I'm getting at.
It's not? Well, then I didn't understand.
What are we trying to protect with the winter overlay? If the residential deer can get along on developed land, what is there about that the migratory deer can't get along?
Okay. Well, there's an issue of habituation. Deer that are, or any animal really, including people, that are exposed to the same sort of harassment continuously, they can adapt to it. Deer on residential areas, they're exposed to it constantly, they adapt to it. We've got large deer numbers in Shady Cove, Jacksonville, Grants Pass, everywhere. Those are deer that they've made a trade-off of adapting to human disturbance, but they don't get hunted, they don't get preyed on. So I think the thing is that a lot of our migratory deer, they are obviously much more skittish. If you go out in the woods and you're pursuing these deer, they're going to run away from you. They haven't had that continuous habituation. And they don't get it because then they move back to the winter range. And like I said, there's a hunted portion of our deer, so it's more difficult for them to get used to people because for half the year people are trying to kill them. So a little more,
The question here,
that would be my response.
One of the problems that I think we're facing now is the fact that you have one state agency that is requiring private ownership to clear vegetation from their lands to prevent the spread of wildfire. And it's the same vegetation that the wild animals need, but yet all of a sudden,